From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Thanks to your bountiful supply of urgent garden questions, my friend Ken Drews and I are being kept busy. And on this edition of the show, we'll tackle subjects from the care required when planting under established trees to what to do with that gift plant like a primula after you enjoy it for a week or two as a centerpiece. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Ken Drews needs no introduction, but I'll offer one anyhow. He's a longtime friend and prolific garden author and photographer with hit books like Making More Plants and The New Shade Garden and Natural Companions. Plus, he makes me laugh, which is very important. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Margaret. You make me laugh, too.
Okay, good. I'm glad it's mutual. I was thinking maybe before we get started with this month's questions, we ask the audience for a different kind of urgent garden question for next month's show. Because in April, to celebrate my all-new version of the book A Way to Garden coming out 21 years later after the first one, you are going to host this show and interview me, right?
Yes, right. Congratulations.
So I was thinking we should ask everyone, and we'll ask on Facebook and everywhere else as well and on the blog, we should ask them what they want you to try to pry out of me, don't you think?
Yes.
So not just your questions, but their questions. So that's the task, audience, is what do you want to know about Margaret? I mean, within reason.
Really?
So that ought to be a real show to remember. Don't miss it, folks. And also a real show to embarrass. But so let's say we get on with the current crop of questions and answers.
Hit me.
Okay. Lindley asks, she says, the local ShopRite, she's in Connecticut, is selling primroses now. They're already blooming. The weather will be below freezing in nights and no better than 40s during the day. Can she plant outside now? Could she leave it in the garage? It's like 40 degrees in there with some sunlight on them. Keep them in the house till it's warmer to plant outside. You know, and she also says they're selling an annual hypoestes. Same questions as the above. So about these like gift plants, floral types of plants especially, and showy foliage plants, what do we do with them when we're lured into bringing them home now?
That's a lot of questions.
Okay. Sorry. Tease it apart. So
well, you know, what we see now are those sort of low-growing primroses, and they come in several colors.
Yeah.
I like the yellow ones because they smell. They have a wonderful fragrance, and the other ones don't really have a fragrance.
Oh, interesting.
But keeping them going until the weather warms at least a bit, maybe for her the beginning of May, end of April, that would be great. And I think if she has a garage of 40 degrees and it has light, maybe sunlight, that sounds pretty good. But as long as you can keep it alive inside, you can plant them outdoors. And sometimes they live quite well. Sometimes they live for a couple of years and bloom again, and then they just disappear. It's funny because I've done some research on these, and most people don't exactly know what they are. Some people say that they're acaulis hybrids, and some people say they're polyantha or polyanthus. So we don't exactly know, but they're fun and they're not that expensive. I've seen people put them in window boxes in warmer climates, not our climate. But that's a cool thing, and she can definitely do it. Now the hypoestes, that's a tropical plant.
I think that's a zone 10 or 11 plant. So that's clearly not going outside until summertime if you want to use it in your pots outside.
What do they call that? Polka dot plant?
Polka dot plant, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Well, those are different stories. So, well, that's an indoor plant, really.
Yeah, it's a, quote, house plant.
And not bad for a terrarium.
Yeah. So, I mean, so you could, theoretically, you could use the primulas for a while in your house and then, you know, enjoy them on the dinner table or whatever and then get them out to a cooler spot. I mean, you could bring them in for a while as long as they don't dry up and crisp up, right? I mean, couldn't you?
Right, and the flowers aren't going to last forever. They do last a long time.
No.
So probably by the time it's time to put them outdoors, they won't be flowering anymore.
Right. But we're not putting them outdoors in zone 5-ish something in Connecticut. We're not, or even 6. We're not doing that right now. We're waiting until.
Maybe she should buy 10 and try them all over, some outdoors,
test.
And then we could learn something
okay.
from their demise.
Oh, dear. All right. So Pamela saw a video on my website. I have a video, I think I call it Making Mosaics, and it's kind of about underplanting beneath trees and shrubs. And this is a really good topic because before we know it, it will be spring everywhere. I mean, spring is already kind of rolling up the South, you know, a little bit, and people are getting outside and doing their garden cleanup, and they're going to want to divide things and start planting and buy things and start planting them. And so she said when she saw this underplanting video, she had this question. She said, "Your lovely and encouraging video makes me want to plant, plant, plant. However, I'm somewhat uncomfortable planting around established trees. The ground is so dense and I'm afraid of damaging the root systems. Any thoughts to pass along as to how to underplant?" So she has a good instinct that you don't take out a giant long-handled shovel and start digging big holes, right?
You are correct.
Yeah.
I'm gulping here.
Yeah, yeah. But
it depends to a certain extent on what the trees are. You know, if you can see the roots, if it's like a shallow-rooted maple or a beech tree, you really have to be careful. And in
magnolia,
those situations.
Magnolias, a lot of them, they have surface roots even, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So if you really want something under them, you know, it's a good place for containers in shade because you can make a container garden. I usually put down 3 bricks that aren't on the roots. You can usually see the roots. And then put an elevated container either with annuals or even with hardy plants. But that doesn't answer all the questions.
So wait, now the bricks are sort of like a shim underneath, like a supporting mechanism, and then you'd put your pots. So the pots aren't just on the ground.
Right, and you also have a little bit of air circulation too,
right.
And the pots drain.
Yeah, okay.
Or, you know, half whiskey barrels.
So you could stage like a vignette in that area without being on top of surface roots, you know, that are obvious. That's one way, but that's not planting perennial things
under.
No,
I know what you
under.
Would do. You would summer your houseplants there and it would look great.
Yeah.
However, I have planted under trees in a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
And one way was to, in one area, I have a woodland garden, and I made the woodland garden under a very tall old white pine. And I covered, if you think of the area under the tree as a big disc or circle, I made kind of a wedge shape, like a pie wedge shaped bed. And the way I did it was put very coarse gravel directly over that small area on the roots, and then some soil mixed with compost, only about 3 or 4 inches. And I planted some wildflowers. In the first year, I had a soaker hose, so they really got established, and that's how I made that woodland garden, and it's doing fine.
Now, can I ask a question before you continue? So you
yeah.
said wildflowers. So what were these things? They were in three-inch pots, but they were tiny divisions. What were they? What did they kind of look like? They were not 2-gallon whatevers, right?
No, they weren't. And that's a good point because one thing you can do is you can get plugs, and now people sell plugs. Plugs are like, you know, if you have a flat with cells and they're small plants. So I didn't do heucheras because I did different things like trillium and bloodroot from dormant parts of the plant. And you can do bulbs that way too. You might do Virginia bluebells from a plug. And those are pretty small root bulb plants. And it's surprising. They really get going almost as fast as some of the gallon plants.
Right.
I took a dibble, you know what that is, like a pointed stick or a very small trowel. And in some cases, I mixed some soil with hydrated, the water-absorbing crystals. I pre-hydrated them and mixed them with soil and put them in a little hole with a little plant just to hold some moisture. Maybe this is getting too esoteric.
No, but we know you're a little nutty, but that's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, if you can see the roots, even you can make stab a little hole carefully in between the roots, just go back and forth. I suppose you could do it with a screwdriver and then pop in a tiny bulb of a small plant in the fall, or you could even put seeds in the holes and start that way, or a dormant part of a bloodroot, something like that has a little rhizome, and that would be done
fairly
soon.
I think that so And I think this is really the key. Whatever you're using, it should be the least intrusive version.
Right.
And of that thing, a small or even a seed, a minor bulb, whatever. But that it's almost like little pocket planting, like you're just taking a tablespoon-sized hole here and, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. the thing that's a little bit confusing about it visually is then when you step back, when you've done this, you step back and it's like these little tiny polka dots spaced, the appropriate space apart, right? Of, could be 6 or 8 inches or could be a foot apart depending on what you're planting. Mm-hmm. And it's not, doesn't look like much. In fact, it's mostly a big pile, a big bed full of mulch. But as you just alluded to, those babies, not only will the roots of the tree thank you for not being aggressive, but the babies, the tiny little things, will take off better too because you didn't ask a big pot-bound perennial that you just bought for $20, to be mm-hmm. shoved into a hole where there's a lot of competition among an established root system, right?
Right. So, competition for moisture.
Yeah. So rather than making anybody suffer, either the new things or the old things, it's like these little tiny added, and you said like a dibber, tool, or I sometimes even just use a tablespoon, a very narrow trowel, one of those tiny little trowels. The first time I ever did this, it was, I didn't know this was what I was supposed to do, but someone sent me a flat of what you just said, plugs or liners, baby perennials,
right,
in the mail. It was Charles Price, Glenn Withey and Charles Price out in Seattle, Withey Price Landscape Design, and great garden designers and great plantsmen. And they were working, especially Charles, on breeding hellebores. He was mm-hmm. crossing hellebores or the Orientalis types, the hybrid hellebores. And he was crossing different colors, and he sent me a flat of, he didn't know exactly what they would be when they reached flowering age. They were small. It was like a flat of like maybe 72. So they were
Ooh.
Small. Yeah, it was a big flat, a big nursery flat, but they were small. And it looked totally ludicrous after I did it. I put them under an old apple tree, I wouldn't want to hurt this century-old apple tree or more than a century-old. And it looked stupid, and I put some trillium, like you said. I had some trillium. I divided up one of my clumps of trillium, which you and I learned to do together, remember?
That's right.
Yeah. So speaking of that, how did we, like with those little things like bloodroot and trillium, when do we do that? Like if we have it in our yard and we want to spread it around under other trees in these little divisions, when do you do that?
I want to ask you a question too. You
yeah.
said you step back and you look at mulch. And
yeah.
Well, I
yeah.
we don't want people covering roots with a whole lot of
no, but
awful
I
bark or anything.
No, but I do use a good quality, a very fine textured mulch. Not very fine, like compost fine, but it's a decayed sort of, composted stable bedding product. So it's mm-hmm. somewhere between shavings and very small chips, but it's been well aged. It's really, great for just an inch or so on top of a new planting. And it's, got some nutrient from the animal wastes and stuff. So,
well, when we were in Massachusetts and we met Evelyn Adams, and she had been dividing her trillium for 50 years.
Yes.
And she had easily 1,000.
Yes.
And she divided them in flower in the spring. And I was horrified.
Right. We thought she was going to kill them. But the
but
proof.
I've been doing it ever since, and it works.
Right. So, right.
Because it's hard to find them when they go dormant. But with bloodroot, I think when the leaves are yellowing, you might dig them up then because they're so easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you know where they are, you could dig them up in the spring too before they have any new growth.
Right.
And when you dig them up, you'll find this rhizome that's like a finger sort of. And as long as each piece has at least one growing eye with bloodroot, it's so easy. You just either snap them apart or cut them apart and plant those little pieces.
Right. So no big shovels under established woody plant root systems, and no deep addition of soil or mulch on top of roots, which can cause sort of suffocation, can cause problems. So we're not doing either one of those things. We're working with the smallest possible, whether they're baby plants that you buy, you ask your garden center, you say, I'm doing this project. I don't want the big perennial, but can you get me the little version of it? Because they buy them in the spring to pot on themselves.
Right.
And you'll pay a premium. You're not trying to get it for the wholesale price, but ask them to surcharge you and double the price or whatever, but give you that tray of, 24 of something or 36 of something or whatever it is.
And I've noticed that some mail order companies are actually selling those now, companies that used to be wholesale only.
Yes. So look for that, or whether it's tiny bulbs or seeds or whatever it is. And make some divisions from things, as I say, sort of, shop in your own garden in early spring, looking for little self-sowns. And, that's what I've also done, is like those hellebores that Charles sent me all those years ago that ended up teaching me about this underplanting method. They have had a billion baby seedlings since, and I've done all my other apple trees. There are five big old apple trees.
Wow.
So the do you know what I mean? I take out the little seedlings that look like the ones that I was gifted all those years ago, but they are now offspring of my current ones. Anyway, and I continue the success. It's not going to look good right away. It's not instant gratification.
And water the first year.
Absolutely. So anyway, so that's a long answer, but for Pamela.
Well, I was interested.
Yeah, Marietta O'Byrne out at Northwest Garden Nursery. She calls it tapestry gardening, and I call it making mosaics. Kind of planting little things in the under the woody canopy, and anyway. Mm-hmm. So
polka dot planting.
Polka dot planting. Well, that sounds pretty bad. So here's another question. Can I link to an older interview, in something recent, an older interview with a flower gardener not long ago, in which she was talking about how sort of, quote, she was underpinning an annual planting, an annual that might get a little floppy otherwise. She was underpinning it, she said, with brush and to keep things from, again, getting floppy. And Sharon and a couple of other readers were like, what is underpinning? What does that mean? What is this brush thing? Now, I know it is a practice called brushing up or using pea brush or whatever, but nobody apparently had heard of that, or among the readers, quite a number hadn't heard of that. Did you know that Robert Frost in 1920 wrote a poem called Pea Brush?
No, but I use pea stakes to brush up.
So apparently in 1920 it was a thing, so much that Robert Frost wrote a whole, and he talks about, I walked down alone Sunday after church to the place where John had been cutting trees to see for myself about the birch he said I could have to bush my peas. So making them bushy, making them using birch twigs that his neighbor John had pruned off something, and he goes on and he talks about how this is going to be the support for the plants to come. And that there were birch boughs everywhere from this pruning job, and he came and he took the bits that he needed. So So apparently it was a thing. But so when have you done it?
Well, this time of year, when I'm cleaning up or pruning things, I try to get the twiggy growth at least 2 feet long, the tips, the ends of branches, and I try to save, well, I do save them in a dry place, because when things flop over, sometimes you want to prop them up and you can't really stake them. It's
right.
It's hard. Pea is a good example, because it's just a vine that's going to flop over.
Yes.
And I put my arm under the floppy part and lift it up with one arm, and then stick a dry, twiggy, brushy thing under it and let it flop back down, and it holds it up.
Right.
And sometimes I can make a little hole in the ground, and the stem of that twiggy part will go into the ground. So it becomes like a shrubby stake, and you really don't see it. It's amazing. So that's called brushing up.
Right.
And the hardest thing is to make sure I remember to save all those twiggy parts.
Well, that's the thing. And it's not ones that are just a single stick shaped like a stake, like just a straight twig. It's the brushy ones, like in the Robert Frost poem, Pea Brush. And he's talking about birch, which is a great one because
perfect.
It divides the fingers of the branch, divide and divide and divide. So when you take those and you stick the main stem down into the ground firmly, the brushy part is sticking up, and it makes this armature, I guess you could say, if you put that all the way down the row of, say, sugar and peas, which are not super tall but could use a little support, you know, anyway, or even slightly taller ones, it's great for that. And I think that's where it got, you know, obviously it got the name from that practice.
Right.
But it's less
sometimes
formal.
Sometimes you just – oh, sorry.
No,
I was just going to say sometimes you walk around and the snow's knocked some little branches off and twigs. And you clean them up and throw them out. Don't throw them out if they're good 2 feet long. And those are usually the twiggy ones, even some maple things fall down.
Right. So if you have – so this particular interview that was being referred to, I think it was even some of these zinnias that are – and I don't remember the names of the varieties, but, you know, they're kind of a little more floppy and loose. They're not the big upright, you know, cutting-y kind of ones, and they have the smaller flowers. And the idea was, you know, by the end of the season, they could be kind of messy, but if you put a little bit of this brush in, it's not formal, like trying to stake it up and tie it to a stake, you know. It's not like that. That wouldn't be appropriate. So it's a little looser version of support. It was kind of cool. And yet, again, it didn't resonate with people. It's one of those things, a word, an idea that's been kind of lost, I think, a little bit. So one quick question. We have about 3 minutes left, so one quick question to finish up. A gardener on the New Jersey-Pennsylvania border, so not that far from you, actually, she wants to create a screen to block a view into a neighbor's yard, preferably something that includes some flowering. So we're talking zone 6-ish. And really it's to block a view. I mean, my first question always when people ask me this, which is a common question, is do you have deer pressure?
Oh, my goodness.
Right? Because, I mean, a long row of something that is available to Bambi, for me, it's like, okay, you're down to almost no choices. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a whole nother, but let's assume she doesn't and we have more choices. Any thoughts that come to mind?
Well, the first question I was thinking is deciduous or evergreen, but I guess if it's a screen, she really wants it to be evergreen if possible. And where she is, depending on if she's got, and she probably does have kind of acidic soil, I would start with the native rhododendron, the Rose Bay, I think it's called.
Right.
And that's a flowering shrub and a big shrub. It gets quite big and it's evergreen and it's native, which is nice. I grow Magnolia grandiflora and people always say, oh, no, you can't grow that. That's a southern magnolia.
Magnolia, right.
And, you know, I'm in a cold zone 6. You're in zone 5, I think.
Yeah, B.
And I grow Edith Bogue, which is a variety of – I grow several Magnolia grandiflora, evergreen southern magnolias, but Edith Bogue is right on the road. She gets splashed with salt spray in the winter. It's gone down below zero. She blooms in the summer. It's not as much bloom as I would like because it's in shade. But and if you prune, she'll keep her branches all the way to the ground. And that's quite something, I think. I don't know if you're browse those plants.
Little Gem is another one of those, isn't it? Little Gem.
Well, Little Gem isn't as hardy.
I see. Okay.
Bracken's Brown Beauty is a small leafed one that's like Little Gem. It's beautiful, but also some, like one out of every 4 winters, it gets pretty ratty looking because it gets damaged. But then it comes right back. But Edith Bogue, it lofts at the snow and the cold.
All right. So that's one thing that you like if you want some evergreen cover that's a little unusual, or two things that you like. One thing I'll say in the last minute is just that, again, you reminded me of Evelyn Adams and when we learned to divide trilliums when they're in bloom. And when we were working on that book of yours, you were kind enough to take me with you on some of the visits to exceptional gardens that you were doing for the Natural Habitat Garden book all those years ago. And I went along, tagged along. And it was I think we sort of coined a phrase like biohedge. In other words, not just one plant in like 50 of one plant stretching the whole length that you want to block, but like a mix of things for different interest for the beneficial insects and birds and animals and stuff like that. So with that as the last word, I will say, Ken Drews, thank you very much. And I'm a little nervous about next month, but I'm looking forward to talking to you. I'll talk to you soon.
I can't wait to see your new book. I can't wait.
Okay. Soon. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free on the podcast version by Stitcher or iTunes, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden or Instagram, same address. Happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.